Thanks so much for that introduction. And I want to thank all the leaders of Tzilut Tchelet for putting together this incredible gathering today. And I want to thank all of you who have actually stuck around after an entire day of speeches to hear me speak. I often tell the story, I heard this apocryphally attributed to Justice Stephen Breyer, who was a justice on the United States Supreme Court, and who was previously a professor at Harvard Law School. And he was grading exams. And on one of the pages of one of the exams, he saw that a student had written him a message. And the student wrote, "Professor Breyer, I want you to know that if I had 1 hour left to live, I would want to spend that hour sitting in your class." So he was very, very impressed. And then he turned the page and he saw that the student continued, quote, "Because Professor Breyer, an hour in your class feels like an eternity." So, I want to thank you for sticking with me to the end. And as I address the symbolism, not only of Tzilut, but, as was mentioned, of Lavan and Tzilut, I hope to address not only the revolution, Shmirat HaMitzvot, and specifically Tzitzit, that has taken place through Tzilut, but also the connection between Tzilut and Lavan and the very eternity of Klal Yisrael itself. It was in 2006 that Dr. Yisrael Robert Amram of Hebrew University was informed that he had just been awarded the Nobel Prize in economics for his groundbreaking work in game theory. And so he was expected to present himself in Stockholm's Royal Palace so that he could be awarded this prestigious prize by the King of Sweden himself. And the awarding of the prize to an Orthodox Jewish academic presented a number of unique challenges, and here I'm citing from several articles about this event. First, each noble laureate was allowed to invite 16 guests for the Almond with 5 children, 19 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren. Not bringing the Ganze Mishpacha was unthinkable. Fortunately, Harold Pinter, Nobel Laureate for Literature, declined to come and gave his 16 spots to the Almond. So that was Hashkachat Pratit. Then there was the royal banquet. The Swedish royal family insisted that any kosher food be indistinguishable from that eaten by all the other guests, but the menu of the Swedish chef was a state secret. So the king's chef agreed to share, just this time, his menu so that kosher versions of his intended courses, including crayfish and scallops and Norwegian lobster on baby lettuce, could be prepared for the omelets. But the most interesting challenge lay in the dress code for the ceremony. As one article describes, quote, "Every male present at the award ceremony, including the omelet's 7-year-old grandson, is required to wear tails and a white bow tie." This is a fancy tuxedo. This was provided by the Nobel Foundation. Since the Torah forbids wearing shatnez, Professor Amram realized that he would have to have these garments checked for shatnez. And this required having the chief rabbi of Sweden pick up one of these outfits and bring it to Israel where it could be checked with a microscope in one of Yerushalayim's many shatnez labs. And the examination revealed that indeed these tuxedos did have shatnez. And so we are further informed, the Amram solved this problem by renting shotless-free formal wear from an Israeli agency and had it flown to Stockholm for the ceremony. And this makes sense, because Israel has long been known as a great source for formal attire. And the truth is that one of the most striking stories, I think, theologically that I've seen in some time, is this one. Because shotless, of course, is singled out by Chazal as a paradigmatic chok, a mitzvah which we perform without any understanding necessarily as to its ultimate purpose. And it was the Rav Zatzal, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in his landmark essay called Majesty and Humility, where he described 2 distinct human personalities, what he called elsewhere in his essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, Adam the First and Adam the Second. For Brisker, is nothing is simple. Everyone else heard about Adam HaRishon. We have not only Adam HaRishon, but also Adam HaShemi. Adam the First is majestic, He seeks to fulfill God's instruction in Gan Eden Milu et Haaretz Chishua. He seeks to conquer the world, achieve scientific breakthroughs, cure disease, build cities and countries, and serve as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partner in creation. But then there's Adam the Second, man who is ever aware of his finitude, who seeks not to conquer, but to find his roots, and who finds fulfillment not in majestic achievements, but in humbling himself before his omnipotent, omniscient creator. Yahadut recognizes both identities as being inherent within our nature, both willed by God. And our Talmidim further notes that in the Torah, the union of Mishpat and Chok, that itself together represents the majesty and humility of human nature and the human mind. The existence of Mishpatim and their roots in natural law signifies the extraordinary intellect with which man has been gifted by God. And yet, Russell Leitch writes, quote, precisely because of the supremacy of the intellect in human life, the Torah requires at times the suspension of the authority logos. Man defeats himself by accepting norms that the intellect cannot assimilate into its normative system. The Judaic concept of chok, he writes, represents human surrender. A man burdens himself with laws whose rationality he cannot write, end quote. Soloveitchik further noted this with regard to Talmud Torah, which is self-premised on the extraordinary abilities of the human mind, especially in studying Shas. And yet he told the story that he once asked his father why so many times throughout Shas, an extended halakhic discussion ends with an unresolved question, with taken. Why didn't Chazal resolve it? Soloveitchik as a child asked his father. And his father, or Moshe Soloveitchik, my great-grandfather, told his son, the Gemara left certain questions unresolved in order to communicate. V'alayid mutzvisim asetazachim mutzavisins. Because Adam tzarich ladat sheyesh marim shvulodim. And our salvation concluded that this is not only a saving halacha, this is a saving korim. This is not only a principle of the study of halacha, but it's one of the foundations of our faith. So here you have someone like Robert Amman, who has lived the life of mind, whose very center in Hebrew, as the article told us, is that, as the article tells us, the name of the center is the Center for the Study of Rationality, who entered academia and achieved fame and fortune entirely through his intellect, through pure thought, according to one of the articles about Professor Amman when he was lying on the couch, perhaps on Shabbat afternoon with his eyes closed, his wife would say to the children, don't bother Amman, he's working. Pure thought. Now, at the pinnacle of his achievement, when he's being honored by the King of Sweden for his intellectual insights, then he obeys Shatnes, whose very essence embodies the notion that there is many a thing that the human mind, no matter how gifted, cannot comprehend. Think of this dialectic of a man receiving the Nobel Prize, and not a Nobel Prize that anyone can win, like the Nobel Peace Prize. Tuxedo, attired in the formal wear of the palace, that is simultaneously, as these articles, and these wonderful articles about this, simultaneously tailored to the dictates of the halakha, thereby embodying at the same time human greatness and limitation, katluta hadam and shifluta hadam, rationality and faith, or as per our salvation, majesty and humility. We gather together today to celebrate Tchela, which, as many of those speaking today have noted, was the original Israelite formal wear, the clothing of Kohanim and kings. But Rav Soloveitchik noted elsewhere that the mitzvah, of course, is not only tchelet, but lavan and tchelet, together comprising the tzitzit, and together reminding us of kol mitzvot Hashem, because the mitzvot contain both mishpat and chok. Only taken together do the tzitzit embody the Torah and this very dialectic within man and within the experience of Judaism itself. Lavan, the terms that are called white by Chazal, denotes in our salvation clarity, distinctness, rationality, that which is self-evident. They bespeak the power of the human mind to perceive, to deduce, to investigate, and to innovate. But then there is Tchelet, which is Domela Yam, the depths of the sea, which is itself the Omen Larakia, the furthest reaches of heaven. The Chelet of Soloveitchik said, symbolizes the perennial mysteries of life, these are his words, that resist rationalization. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that the very blueness of the sky is due only to our distance from which we observe it. In his words, while the color white refers to the clearly perceptible, Tchelet refers to a realm that is only barely grasped. Or as I would add, it is a reminder of what Hamlet said to Horatio, that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And I would add as well that it's striking that specifically Tchelet, that overrides in Halacha, in Mitzvah Shatnez itself, both in the Bidei Kumna and the Doraita, when we have the Bidei of our Bakan Fok that's made out of land. So if Shatnez itself is a Chok, Tchelet represents the most mysterious conceptions and the very limits of human intelligence and understanding. For centuries, if not millennia, Kal Yisrael wore tzitzit that was purely Lavan, purely white. Lacking Tchelet, they relied on the opinion, which is normative according to most Rishonim, that Tchelet in a Rakhavet of Talaman. That without Tchelet, one can still fulfill the mitzvah with Lavan. That opinion, the opinion of Yehuda, that Tchelet Rakhavet of Talaman, and Lavan Rakhavet of Tchelet, that opinion, our salvation said, may not be normative halachically, but it remains true philosophically. Lavan and Tchelet united together, only then embody the Torah. The reason and the mysterium tremendum taken in tandem represent the others. We're now able to understand how the story of Tchelet's return in our age is actually represented by this mitzvah itself. For the story of the rediscovery of Tchelet is a story of Lavan and Tchelet, of Adam the First and Adam the Second, of science and service of faith, of the joining of Jewish ingenuity and covenantal loyalty, the utilization of worldly knowledge in solving a millennia-old mystery, and thereby allowing us to fulfill the mitzvah. And is there any better person to embody this message, this combination of majesty and humility, of worldliness, and the seeking of our roots than Rav Herzog? This was a man of science and letters who traveled all over the world, and who was the chief rabbi of Ireland, a country which, as one of his successors, or Emmanuel Jacobus, would put it, he said he was the chief rabbi of Ireland, a country that was 93% Catholic, 7% Protestant, and the rest was Jewish. I can't actually help quoting here. How did this only get this if you're from America? How many people here are Americans? Raise your hands. If you're Canadian, that counts too. So you all know, you heard of Yogi Berra, of course, yes? For those Israelis who don't know, Yogi Berra was a philosophical genius of our age. So he famously was told that the mayor of Dublin, Ireland, was Jewish. So he said, the mayor of Dublin is Jewish, only in America. So here we have a man who represents worldliness, a student for President Roosevelt. And as a student, and yet, as a student in London 100 years ago, in the capital of what was then the greatest empire in the world, his thoughts turned not to modernity but mystery, to the royal purple and blue of a people exiled from their land long ago, a people with whom he would return and ultimately leave his Maharshi. It's therefore so striking that Tchelet Lavan, or Kehov Lavan, became the colors and the symbol of the state that he ultimately served as Maharshi. When he was asked, according to one of the articles, what was most memorable about his Nobel experience, Robert Allen cited the seeing the blue and white of the flag of Israel flying over the royal palace. Interestingly, as the article notes, this was also a memorable moment for Israel's first Nobel laureate, Shai Agnon, who said to his wife, "Did you ever dream that you would see the flag of Israel flying over the royal palace?" And Agnon's wife said, "I don't really have dreams about flags." In truth, Rav Soloveitchik's explanation of the union in blue and white and tzitzit allows us to better appreciate not only the resurrection of Tchelet in our times, but the fulfillment of the dream of Jewish sovereignty itself. Zionism in its secular incarnation was predicated on the majestic ability of the people to achieve even the impossible in Tier 2 and Zohar Adah. And it was indeed an immense and majestic human achievement. the return of a people to their land, making the desert bloom, creating a flourishing modern state, a mighty military, a source of scientific breakthroughs, and now what my friend Dan Sino calls the startup nation, a country that I believe has won more Nobel Prizes per capita than the United States, a true testament to Jewish ingenuity. Yet for all the famous photographs in this country's history, the most mifursam of all is not an image of military conquest, or Israeli Nobel laureates receiving their accolades, or Ben-Gurion declaring the Israeli independence, or Begin signing the Camp David Accords. It is not a photo of Israeli generals or scholars or prime ministers, but of simple soldiers in David Rubinger's photograph, standing staring up at the newly liberated Har HaBayit in Kotel HaMaravi. As another friend of mine writes, Yossi Khan Halevi, as he puts it, for all the majestic achievements of the modern state of Israel, this image endures, writes Yossi, because, quote, because of the humility it conveys. At their moment of triumph, the conquerors are themselves conquered. Many of the paratroopers, Yossi tells us, identify themselves as Israelis first, Jews only a distant second. And yet, as one paratrooper put it, at the wall I discovered that I'm a Jew. Yossi further writes that in this photo, the paratroopers, the epitome of Zionism's new Jews, stand in gratitude before the Jewish past, suddenly realizing that they owe their existence to its persistence and longing. To put it slightly differently, those soldiers at the Har HaBayit realized, as Rav Soloveitchik said in his analysis of Tzitzit, that only a nation sustained by Tehillah, meaning sustained by faith, by emunah, at a time when all rationality indicated otherwise, only such a people could have been motivated to reconstitute a state in the land of their fathers after 2,000 years of exile. The story of Israel itself is thus captured truly by the Levant and the Tehillah of the Israeli flag, because Israel is a symbol of both human achievement and divine mystery. Zionism sought in statehood the normalization of the Jewish people, the end of anti-Semitism. In the end, it achieved anything but that. Israel is a flourishing modern democracy, but it's also a reminder of the mystery of Jewish chosenness. As the historian Paul Johnson points out, in the 20th century, over 100 completely new independent states came into existence, but Israel is the only one whose creation can fairly be called a miracle. Israel, in other words, truly is Levant and Tehillah, simultaneously a modern democratic marvel, and also a reminder of the mystery that is the endurance of the Am HaNivchar. Yossi Klein Halevi concludes his reflection on Rubinger's photograph by noting that often looking at Yerushalayim, he doesn't necessarily feel that he's living something special. But then he writes, I suddenly remember where I am. And, he says, I ask myself what it is about this strange little people that continually finds itself at the center of international attention, repeatedly on the front lines against totalitarian forces of evil, Nazism, Soviet communism, now Jihadism, all of which mark the Jews as their primary obstacle to achieving world domination. At those moments, Yossi writes, I feel gratitude for having found my place in this story. And so today's conference is not only a celebration of a scientific discovery or of the development in the history of the Halakha, but more than that, as well. Pondering the symbolism of Levant and Tehillah allows us to find our own place, to find our own place in the story that is Am Yisrael and in the Nazi Israel. Growing up in Chicago, in the Salvation Council of Chicago, part of our Erev Shabbat routine was to take off our tzitzit before Shabbat, because of the famous chumrah from Rav Chaim Brisker, that to be choshesh, the few Rishonim who passed it like Rabbi Yehuda, that HaTcheilat Ma'akevet at HaLavan, and HaLavan Ma'akevet at HaTcheilat, in the Mordechai and the Baal Yitzhar, passing the hand. So just to be safe, in case our tzitzit are pasul, and then we'd be carrying our Shabbat, we would take it off before Shabbat, and then, at when Shabbat ended, which for us was around 3 days after Shkiyah, we could put the tzitzit back on. Salvation family are not all associated with Rav HaTcheilat, but the truth is, we have always remembered the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, that HaTcheilat Ma'akevet at HaLavan, the HaLavan Ma'akevet at HaTcheilat. The Halakha may not be in accordance with the Shita, but I would propose it as a suggested metaphor for the future of the flourishing, or for the future of the state of Israel. HaTcheilat Ma'akevet at HaLavan, the HaLavan Ma'akevet at HaTcheilat. To truly flourish, Israel must embody both majestic ingenuity and humbling mystery. It must make manifest Lavan, flowering of Jewish genius, many more Nobel Prizes, many more occasions for the flag of Israel to fly over the royal palace of Sweden, but also to say that Israel is a symbol of Jewish chosenness, Jewish endurance, and please God, a source of many more miracles yet to come. Thank you very much.